bills piling up? CME can help you wrap up your debt into one simple, manageable signature loan with rates starting as low as 8.75% APR. Instead of juggling stacks of statements, let CME help you unwrap peace of mind this season. Federally insured by NCUA, APR means annual percentage rate. Terms apply. Subject to membership eligibility and approval. Visit cmefcu.org for additional details.
If one big beautiful bill has left you with one big confusing question, turn to BHM CPA Group. Their experienced professionals break down complex changes in tax law, accounting, and business regulations so you can make informed decisions with confidence. Simplifying the complex is what BHM CPA Group does best. Don't wait. Visit bhmcpagroup.com and let's get to work. BHM, because running a business is hard enough. Your finances shouldn't be. Visit bhmcpagroup.com today.
It's The Wonky Show. We're looking at student loans today. Should interest rates come down or go up? There's also some lessons to learn from Cambridge. There always is. OFS has a new data set to play with and a whole clutch of issues in drama schools. It's all coming up.
Well, first of all, they don't do gravy in chip shops, so that's outrageous. But second of all, because it's completely priced out, if you base what where I currently am to London, I would never be able to live in London based on the weights.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to take the antihistamines to cope with the pollen of HE policy. As usual, a couple of fantastic guests. In Clapham, Aaron Porter is Associate Director Governance at Advanced HE and Chair of BPP University. Aaron, your highlight of the week, please.
Hello, Jim. Yeah, my highlight of the week. I do a little bit of mentoring for student union officers, but in their role as student governors. And it's at that point of the year where they're at transition, and it was just actually just lovely to hear about some of their reflections and achievements in what's been a really difficult year. But actually hearing the change that some student union officers are making with their institutions was really heartening, something that happened earlier this week.
And in sunny Preston, Steph Lomas is VP Education at UCLAN Students Union. Steph, your highlight of the week, please.
Hi, Jim. Well, following on from Aaron, my highlight would be receiving my 360 report and seeing all the lovely comments from both staff and students on my work as I move on from the union.
A reign of terror comes to an end as a cloud moves into the sunshine in Preston. Anyway, yes, we start this week with student loans. Two student unions are telling the government to increase the interest rate on student loans. Aaron, what on earth's going on here?
Well, yes. I mean, student finance never seems to be far from the news. And there's been a flurry of stories relating to higher education finance. But yes, beginning with this story, looking at LSE and the University of Sheffield students unions who have got together, they commissioned London Economics to look at ways in which you may be able to reward or rebate students some money given the experience that they've had this year. And of course, counterintuitively, it's actually by increasing the rate of interest on the student loans that you can generate more money into the system that would allow you to, or allow the Treasury at least, to do something different with that money. And the argument put forward by these students' unions is that if the interest rate is raised sufficiently, it could generate enough cash for £2,700 to be put back into the pockets of students. Of course, there's lots of contested arguments about what should happen with student loan interest. Others have argued, including the former minister, Chris Skidmore, that student interest rates should be reduced as a way of benefiting students. So it's a lively argument. But my personal view is that given the year that students have had, anything that's cost neutral for universities but puts cash in the pockets of students has to be given some serious consideration. So I think it's a welcome contribution.
Steph, obviously, there's a couple of things going on here. On the one hand, it tells us some interesting things about, you know, what might happen out the back of the Augur review response in the autumn. But, you know, specifically, what these student unions have done is try to solve this lots of students wanting a refund or rebate problem, doesn't it? So, you know, what's your sense? Are students still upset about the way the year's gone? Are they still hankering after some kind of compensation or rebate or whatever it is?
I think that's always going to be the case. I mean, it was said in the letter that was published by the student unions in The Guardian, you know, we do believe in an ideal world that education should be free, but in a year where students are calling for compensation on fees, we need to create a different situation. I think given the fact that it was only on May 17th where the government was said, right, we can all return to on-campus learning, at that point students are taking assessments. They're not really thinking about travelling back to campuses and regaining that lost year, and I don't think they would be able to, even if they wanted to. I think students are looking for some form of understanding and consideration in terms of fees to show that this year has not been a normal year, and they want that sort of evidenced within what they are paying for. And I think it's an interesting suggestion here about this cost-neutral solution to universities and the taxpayers, because I think that's always been quite a political argument around, you know, what we do for students and how the reaction from the taxpayer will be. And obviously with universities and the sector as a whole financially being quite precarious at the moment, I think anything that is going to be cost neutral to all parties is something to be highly considered.
Yeah, there's a really interesting distinction, I think, to be made. In what way has student experiences been, you know, undermined or a challenge this year? I think providers will argue, from a learning outcomes point of view, whilst things have been done differently, to a large degree, learning outcomes have been preserved. But I think whatever your perspective is on that, it's the wider experience that has clearly been diminished. And I think it's on that basis that there are legitimate and genuine grounds for students to be given some sort of refund or rebate. So I suspect this will rumble on, not least because we know there are a record number of complaints in the system. Many of them are working their way through institutional complaints processes at the moment. Some of them will, I'm sure, get to the Office of the Independent Adjudicator. So I think this could run and run for at least another 12 months.
Aaron, let me ask you, a question about this. It's cost neutral, this proposal. It's economic modelling from a couple of student unions. And quite a bit of chat on Twitter saying, oh my God, you know, this is hardly, you know, the riots of 68. Why, you know what I mean? Why are students unions, you know, kind of, you know, acquiescing in this way and so on? But yet, on the other hand, as we record today, you know, we're hurtling towards a comprehensive spending review on a day when an education recovery czar who thought he was going to get 10 billion could only get 1.5 billion out of the Treasury. So I'm really caught between this kind of, you know, should people be pragmatic in the run up to the CSR on student loans and the student loan scheme, or should students be radical? And you know, that debate will not be one you're unfamiliar with.
Yeah, well, it's very clear that higher education is way, way, way down the shopping list of priorities for the Treasury and indeed the government. So the idea that, buckets and buckets of free money is going to be thrown towards higher education is for the clouds, in my view. So I think it was really, really welcoming to see a couple of students' unions supported by a larger number try and roll their sleeves up and engage in the detail in a pragmatic, practical solution that really would seem to be quite a win-win. I think it makes a nice contrast from some of the nicely principled but simply outlandish calls that we've seen from parts of the sector, from parts even of students' unions in NUS over the last few years. I think this was a much more serious contribution, and as a consequence worthy of a great deal more respect than it got in some quarters.
Steph, let me ask you, so you know, as we get towards the autumn, obviously there are questions over whether or not the government will implement types of number controls, either on minimum entry criteria for students or minimum exit outcomes in terms of, you know, the famed search for low value courses. You could also reduce the amount of money you give to universities per head. That would be controversial in lots of quarters for obvious reasons. But I guess the other option here is you make the loan scheme cheaper. And it strikes me that, you know, when Aaron was knocking around 10 years ago fighting the tripling of tuition fees, that was a fairly easy, you know, slogan to sell to students in terms of campaigning. But if the proposals on the table in the autumn are things like, you know, 40-year terms for student loans or, you know, changes to the repayment threshold, that's not really as kind of interesting and unifying, is it, for students from a campaigning perspective?
I think that the bigger issue is that students, as much as we try to understand the system in terms of loan repayments, it's a really complex system to us, and we just want education. That's what we're there for. And, you know, I was a student that came through non-traditional means. I'd have signed anything in order to get the education that I'm desperate for. So I think that there's a bigger conversation about making sure that everyone has real, like, intrinsic knowledge about what they are signing up for and what things mean. And half of the conversation there is about making sure that the language is accessible and that students can actually understand what's going on. I think there's an interesting point that you raised, though, Jim, around numbers, limiting numbers. And that is that if we do that, if that is what happens, we are going to lose out on so much of what makes education great, the different stories that come together. Because what is taught and what education is not simply what is put into lectures and webinars or seminars. It is what students teach each other and what students teach the institution as well. And I think if they were to do that, they would absolutely decimate what higher education can be, which is transformative for everyone.
I think what makes this more complicated as well is that higher education appears to be in a sort of financial battle with further education and adult learning, and potentially even now schools with this kind of catch-up premium and redress that's been talked about over the last 24 hours. And so, you know, when higher education is put up against those two, and the government has made clear intentions that it is going to support a new lifelong learning entitlement, I think on its own terms is a really welcome a policy announcement that will allow, you know, second chance learners and adult learners to reskill and upskill. But if that comes at the cost of levelling up other sectors, but levelling down higher education, that still needs to be called out for what it is. And so it's going to make the sort of nuance of the argument really quite complicated.
But there's a reality there, isn't there? So, you know, if it proves to be the case that trying to implement, you know, student number controls on the basis of minimum entry criteria actually proves to be really complicated, and, you know, you'd end up being the kind of enemy of opportunity. And if it's the case that lowering the unit of resource would make things very, very difficult for these kind of large anchor institutions, you've got one option left, which is to play with the terms and conditions that students have signed up for. And Steph, you said, you know, it's really important that students understand what they're signing up for. Part of the problem, of course, is that when it comes to student loans, the government can retrospectively change the terms and conditions after you've signed up for the loan. So, you know, isn't it a decent guess that, you know, in the end, what will happen when they sort of run out of time in October, November, is that they'll just make graduates pay back more?
Absolutely. I think that's always going to be the case. From what I remember when I was a student to now is completely different. And it's a case of that constant, well, how can they do that? And like you said, they can do it retrospectively, whereas we know that in other sort of legal terms, they would never be able to put in retrospective measures in other cases. But it always seems that no matter the time or day, it is either the graduate or the student themselves that is constantly put at a detriment. And it's a shame, really, because they are the future, the present and the future of, you know, the UK and, you know, the world as a whole. And we should be supporting them and nurturing that rather than sticking it to them at every opportunity when it's just the simplest option to the government.
Aaron, you're a politics watcher. At the macro level, why does it feel like this government isn't really interested in people that are under 50? You know, what's going on? Why is there such a lack of focus on youth unemployment, students, you know, this today, a lack of focus on schools? What's going on there?
When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
I think it's votes, simple as that. You know, the evidence suggests that you know, over the age of 50, much more likely to vote Conservative than any other party, and they've really focused in on that as a government. And you know, to be fair, it's paid electoral dividends to Boris Johnson so far. I think it puts problems in storage. I think there is a real issue with access to the housing market and good employment and well-paid jobs, which is, you know, currently being felt by people in their 20s and in their 30s. But it isn't making a difference to the electoral map in a way in which governments are really being pressed. And, you know, I think we've got to ask some questions of the opposition as well. You know, they're yet to really sketch out what their policy agenda is under Keir Starmer. At the moment, it seems like there's going to be a bit of a focus on social care at one end and maybe education, but probably schools at the other end. Arguably, they are the most important things to fix, but it leaves that squeezed middle in terms of age and also that squeezed middle in terms of incomes being left with no real advocates for them in the political arena.
Now, Wonky's editor Debbie McVitie met up with Alice Chilver this week, who's chair of the Women's Higher Education Network. Let's find out more.
Alice, thank you so much for taking the time. Tell us about the campaign that you've just launched.
Well, there are today in the UK, there are 35 black women professors. 35. There are some 12,000 white men professors, almost 5,000 white women professors, 1,500 black and minority ethnic men, and 500 almost black and minority ethnic women. But if you look down at that data a little bit more, the picture is really quite stark. So in terms of the race of women professors, there are only 35 black women professors in the UK higher education sector today, compared to 180 Asian women professors, for instance. So we've got a real, real problem, and we need to do something about it. And, you know, our institutions are aware of racial inequalities and institutional racism, and there is lots happening at the moment in this space. But I'm not convinced that our universities really know what to do. And I'm not convinced that we're really going to be able to make progress quickly. And that's what WEN is all about. WEN is an institution that is, sorry, WEN is a social enterprise. We are dedicated to equity of opportunity for women working in higher education. And we're trying to speed up progress by helping women to achieve their ambitions, but also by working with institutions to remove systemic and cultural barriers. So we are completely shocked by this statistic of 35 black women professors and want to see change happening, and change happening fast. So we've set ourselves a target of doing something in order to be able to see 100 black women professors being in post. And just yesterday, or just this week, we have launched, we have officially announced the launching of a programme called 100 Black Women Professors Now.
Fantastic. And earlier in the week, you held an event at which, you know, you heard from some of those current black women professors about their experience. What jumped out at you in terms of the particular challenges and barriers that those women have faced in their careers?
Well, I think what's really important to understand is that not all women are the same. Not all black women are the same. Everybody has a different experience of progressing their career in higher education, a different experience of, in some cases, racism, bullying and harassment, very unpleasant aspects of culture. Not everyone has all of those experiences, though, and everyone's experience is unique. And I think that's definitely one of the things that stood out from the launch event for the programme this week, that it's really important to understand everyone's own unique experiences and treat everyone as individuals.
And what's your call to action, I guess? I mean, both for universities, but also for, you know, allies, people who support and care about this agenda and want to be kind of great allies to seeing the results you're looking for.
Yeah, so we have launched this programme. It's a pilot programme. So we've got six fantastic organisations that are going to be working with us to see if we can accelerate change. So that's the Open University, Manchester University, Loughborough, Leeds, De Montfort, and the University of East London. So we are partnering with these institutions to deliver a programme over the next 12 months where we'll be working with their vice-chancellors, senior leaders, heads of department, and black academic women too. So in terms of people across the sector getting behind this agenda and supporting this to happen, what I would encourage is for you to be thinking about in your institutions whether accelerating change in this way would be something that you'd like to do, and whether therefore you might like to partner with us in future years. Also, there's lots more discussion to be had about the rest of the pipeline. So this programme is looking at women who already have an academic tenured position and how we can accelerate their progress. But what about those women who don't yet have an academic tenured position, who are on fixed term contracts? And in fact, some of the data reveals that fixed term research staff are amongst the most racially diverse population of staff in the sector. So how can we make sure that the sector is able to retain that sort of talent? So we need to have all of those sort of conversations, and we're about to start some focus groups and set up some other opportunities to start exploring what we could do in that space. So if you want to get involved, please get in touch with Gwen. But I think it's much more personal than that too. You know, I think that what we really need to be thinking about doing is looking around at our teams. You know, how diverse really are they? Looking around at the people that we interact with, that we collaborate with at work and between our institutions. What is the level of diversity like, and why is it like that, and what can we do differently? So I think, you know, this starts with each of us individually as individuals looking around ourselves. We also need to do work ourselves, each of us, in understanding our own racial identity. And I think that critically, we need to make sure that we know what racism looks like, because it's sometimes can be difficult to detect or not obvious to see, but we need to make sure that we understand what racism looks like, so that when we do see it, we can call it out, we can do something. And so we sort of need to prepare ourselves as well to be confident to know what to say when we see it. So I think that, you know, we can talk about institutional strategies and we could talk about, you know, national programs, but this is work that really, you know, needs to start at an individual personal level. And I think understanding what racism is, being able to recognize it and knowing and being confident to call it out when we see it is something that we can each do.
Now, meanwhile, this week, boffins at the University of Cambridge, you'll notice that when people are inventing things in the press, they're boffins, and when they are complaining about things, they're dons. But anyway, this week, boffins at the University of Cambridge have released details of two studies carried out last year on its COVID-19 control strategies. Steph, fill us in.
So, yes, with September around the corner, alongside a horde of new students who feel they are ODA freshers, there is a lot to be discussed. We've seen that the COVID-19 Genomic UK Consortium analysed over 446 genomes from the university testing programmes and found that 70% of all the cases belong to a singular genetic cluster, likely dispersed by students from a singular nightclub, and with limited transmission in academic settings, but a much higher transmission within student accommodation, there's definitely something to be discussed here. The government roadmap is leading us to believe that the majority of public spaces are going to be at full capacity by autumn. And with that prediction being that it's unlikely that 18 to 22-year-olds are going to be fully vaccinated by then. So with the University of Cambridge releasing this study, alongside, you know, the government roadmap, etc., there's a lot of questions to be had. You know, what are universities going to do? Should it be down to them to decide individually? Are they going to be setting themselves up for a compare the COVID plan reaction similar to last year? Should they be delaying their start dates? Should they be phasing returns? Like, what do they do? And I think the more important question for me is, how do they communicate that with students? Do they give them the rosy picture, or do they tell them the belts and braces version with all of the contingency plans? And when do they tell them? Do they tell them now, or do they apply for an extension to that communication?
Aaron, this is, you know, there's three, I'm thinking of three rooms here in my head. There's a sort of lecture theatre, which lots of people are discussing. Well, you know, it may well have to be 2 metres plus, so we'll run those online. Fine. There's your sweaty nightclub in a basement somewhere in Cambridge. They're normally quite small from memory, which, you know, as far as we know, there won't be any restrictions on come June the 21st, but will there? You know, will the 21st of June announcement be different? What do you do about, in particular, young people that haven't been double vaxxed in terms of those spaces? And then you've got, you know, institutional accommodation, barracks, care homes, halls. And, you know, if this study is telling us, as Steph points out, that all of the transmission was in halls and nightclubs, we can't only secure lecture theatres in September, can we? Don't we have to deal with the other two?
Absolutely. And the sooner that that becomes clearer in the eyes of the government and for the planners at universities and the management teams of universities, the better. I think we're sleepwalking into yet another chaotic period for universities. And I don't blame universities. They've been listening attentively and responding to the government advice as it's been moving and changing over the last 12 or 14 months. But we have a challenge coming up. Let's be in no doubt about it. We know that for the school leaver population going to university, they're going to be amongst the last to receive their vaccine. And so the prospect by September, October, that they're going to be double vaccinated, I think, is unlikely. And even if we continue to make really good strides with our domestic population being vaccinated, we've got the issue with international students. And so we'd still be needing to face this question. I think it seems so ridiculous that we would make this much progress as a country, apply restrictions, let's say, when it comes to teaching, and then not apply any restrictions when it comes to halls and accommodation. Now, I know that the wiggle room for universities to come up with workarounds is relatively limited, but surely we must have learned the lessons of the return of what happened last September, and then the movements across the country before and after Christmas. Surely it can't be third time unlucky, but I fear we may be, as I say, sleepwalking into yet another chaotic period.
Steph, you've been knocking around all the important meetings this year as the too little too late guidance has repeatedly dropped at entirely the wrong moment. You know, what is required here? What would be the ideal? Are we talking, you know, earlier guidance from DfE, or is it, you know, some kind of financial underwriting? Should we be telling students to move house to their university town or city, or should we tell them to stay away? You know, what in an ideal world, given the factors that, you know, you've read about in these Cambridge studies, what would we do? You know, what would the government be doing?
I think that's a really difficult one to answer, because I think for different student populations, it will be different answers dependent on what they are coming to university for. Some of us do come for the academic experience. Some of us come, you know, to find ourselves in a different place and rediscover who we are. I was more academic, obviously. So I think there are different reasons why students come to university. And so I don't think there is one catch-all for that will please everyone. I think what would be really important, though, is that it is a community discussion. So it's not just the university working within its confines, but working with the local economy around it, working with nightclubs to ensure that they are safe for their students. Because I truly believe that the duty of care that universities have extends to the community around it. So I think working with them, but I do think it is massively important that when universities have a plan, that they tell students, so students can make reasonable decisions. Universities cannot make the decisions for all students. But
get your shopping done right this holiday season with Big Air Columbus. Right now, you can get $100 off Elite Player Passes at Big Air, which is unlimited play all day, any day. Or buy one $25 gift card, get a free pair of holiday grip socks, plus a 1.5 hour pass to use after the new year. Big Air is the perfect gift for the kids in your family. So get your holiday shopping done right with Big Air Columbus. Stop by today inside Fieldhouse USA at the Polaris Mall or online at bigairusa.com.
It can and must give students the information to make reasonable, cost-effective in some circumstances, decisions that will, you know, affect them not just now, but 4 years to come.
And you know, Aaron, as Steph points out, you know, that this is different for different students. I mean, it's also different for different providers, isn't it? I mean, one of the things about the Cambridge studies is that they found, you know, quite a bit of transmission between students, not that much transmission between students and the local community. But, you know, if I think about the cliches that would attach themselves to Cambridge, they're different to the cliches that I might imagine for ARU up the road, right? So, you know, the being able to transpose the lessons from this sort of stuff is difficult in different providers, isn't it? And you know, the reality is it's going to be a chaotic clearing period. No one really knows what's going to happen with A-levels and B-techs and so on. There's, you know, there are real pressures on universities to recruit, despite the fact that in some cases it might not be in students' best interest to go through what we went through last, you know, September, October, November, December again.
Well, this is where, and it's played out in the DfE guidance, you know, when those of us that have had to read the DfE guidance, we've been reading a description of a particular type of university experience, and sometimes that translates to the institutions we're involved with, and oftentimes it doesn't. But you're right, there is a financial reality here which will provide a real conflict for universities with their decision-making over the summer. We were talking earlier about pressures on higher education finance, some of the auger recommendations possibly on their way down. So universities will feel, at one level, a pressure to get bums on seats, to try and get as many students that are still paying them £9,250 before it turns into £7,500, to put it very crudely. And so I think, you know, there will be some real challenges for universities trying to get money through the door whilst also preserving and protecting the student experience.
And Steph, the other thing that strikes me, you know, that my kind of three buildings thing, you've got your lecture theatre, you've got your nightclub, you've got your, you know, hotel style halls. And obviously not every provider has all three. Not every provider focuses on all three. And actually, not every student would frequent all three. But nevertheless, all three are, you know, kind of centres of viral transmission. The thing that strikes me about all three is they're all really efficient. And there's lots of talk about, you know, more small group teaching or being able to deliver a social experience in smaller groups, you know, the kind of stuff that people are doing at the moment in groups of six, you know, that kind of thing. But the reality is that a lot of the student experience is delivered in spaces that are engineered for efficiency. And the problem with that is when you've got an airborne, you know, virus causing a global pandemic, you have to take a lot of that kind of efficiency out of play for safety reasons. And that, I mean, there's not really a way around that in terms of the student experience, is there?
I think it's about communicating with students and co-creating that experience with them. That's what's important, finding out what is important to students and working with them to create what is possible. And again, it's about giving them the information for them to be reasonable. I think one of the biggest issues over the past year is keeping students in the dark. So students read something, believe that's the experience they're going to get. But when they come onto campus or when they receive that email telling them what their student experience is going to look like, it's a bit too little too late. And the uproar is already there because they've waited long enough for this moment to be in education. And it feels like that's not the experience they're getting. So I think it's more about making sure that we are communicating with students and working with them, and especially working with students' unions, which are really important in sort of negotiating this turbulent time that we are going to be going through.
Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's Academic Registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HU.
So with that medieval curriculum that you did your general arts degree first and then you studied them further to become a master so that you went on to teach, it was quite clear that you did that in the general sum of knowledge of mankind in arts, in the kind of broader sense of what you might know about. What you would then go on and do, if you were interested in this, is study one of the higher faculties. And there were three higher faculties: law, theology, and medicine. These are the things that you could only do after you had first taken your arts degree. And there's a remnant of that, both in terms of in the UK, but also in the US. So, for example, at Oxford, you now, once you've got your MA, you can go on and do a Bachelor in Civil Laws as a postgraduate degree, because that's the beginning stage of starting the work. But the most people were aiming for the degree of Doctor, and you could only get the degree of Doctor in a higher faculty. There was no, in the UK, there wasn't a tradition of getting a higher doctorate in arts. So slowly these develop into slightly unregulated. The people would come back and do an exercise, submit some work, and they would get these higher degrees in a lovely red gown. And that's how those higher degrees went. So when the reforming exercise comes in the 19th century, and universities are starting to develop different subjects, they add to these higher degrees, degrees in letters or science, and therefore a higher degree starts on that thing. And there's also a sense that that prolonged study that you might do after first having done your degree should be rewarded by some kind of doctorate degree. It's not really a research degree, but it's a kind of way of recognising people might do that. And so there's a sense that we might take the Doctor of Science degree and make it into a research degree. But the other tradition, which comes to us both directly from Germany but also from the US, is this notion that having done your first general degree, you then specialise. So the Americans, the specialisation in a professional degree comes at the postgraduate level. You don't study undergraduate law, you study it at postgraduate level. And that's more of a direct inheritor of that medieval course structure. General education first, then specialise in professional education afterwards. But also, they take on the idea that a doctorate degree in arts might also be something that we might take forward. Now, the German translation, the German way that they would approach that, is that they describe their arts faculty as the philosophical faculty. So it's a doctorate in philosophy that the Americans take forward. That idea that you would have a doctorate in philosophy, a doctorate in a specialised area of knowledge that wasn't law, theology or medicine. And so Yale first starts with that, and then there's a development as Johns Hopkins University to develop a rigorous training towards the PhD. And that's set up. And so if you want to do further study, you can, if you're an American, you can go to one of these research degrees. Generally, if people want to do that further study, they go to a German university to take a philosophical degree. Now, all of that shifts because with the First World War, no one can go to Germany to take a first up one of these degrees. And so this forces the issue. Forces the issue in the UK two ways. Firstly, there are Americans who want to come to Europe and do further study, and we don't have anything appropriate for them to do. And that becomes particularly clear in the beginning of the 20th century because Rhodes Scholars have been given large amounts of money to come to the UK, but they really want to do more study and they want to have a degree to reward them for that. But also because that extra training of scientists is something that they want to get together. So the UK has a wonderful moment of coherence and organisation, and facilitated by the government, actually also the War Office, organises a conference to set up the philosophy degree, that PhD. And the universities all come, all send delegates, and they set out the requirements so that actually, given that we normally, you know, protesting about our autonomy and doing things, we come together in a pool so that PhD sets off in pretty much the same way across all of the UK universities. And so it goes off. Obviously, there are some quirks, Oxford calling it a DPhil rather than a PhD, but actually we go off in a relatively straightforward way because we've come together to deal with a market for doing these things, an opportunity to take forward higher learning, and a chance to steal the thunder on our counterparts in Europe. So there we go, a great development in English higher education. Or British higher education.
Now, it's like a machine. The Office for Students has fired out yet another set of experimental statistics. Aaron, tell us more about today's data.
Yes, another data download from the Office for Students. This time, it's what they describe as experimental statistics looking at geographical distribution of the local graduate opportunities. So this report presents a method for grouping travel to work areas, which capture local areas based on commuting patterns according to local graduate earnings and rates of highly skilled employment, drawing on the LEO or the census from 2011's data. So it's split into sort of five quintiles, Q1 being the lowest rates of graduate opportunity and Q5 being the highest. And perhaps unsurprisingly, you've got in Q5 and Q4, there's a bit of a huddle around London and the southeast with the strongest opportunities, and much of the northeast and the coastline along there forming a large chunk of the Q1. There's also the other thing to perhaps draw out is the dimension in with regard to race. So black graduates are almost four times more likely to live in areas with the highest graduate opportunity rates. And OFS compared only graduates living in these top quintile areas and found that nearly three quarters of white graduates earned above the threshold or in higher level study compared to just 60% of black graduates. So I don't don't think it told us anything desperately new, but it just reinforced that by the basis of geography and by ethnicity, there are still stubborn gaps to be addressed.
Steph, you're a talented, sharp, you know, success story graduate from UCLan. You've got a graduate job, right? You know, you've got a job after being a SAB, haven't you? What are you going to do? Tell us.
Absolutely. I'm going to be working with the university in their academic registry team.
What, in Preston?
In sunny Preston.
Yeah, but Steph, you're going to mess up the stats.
I know. I'm
like, why aren't you on a train, on a Virgin train to Euston, where you can, you know, come and eat your, you know, pret salads every day, where, you know, your graduate salary will be about $6,000 more, and then you'll prop up the university's numbers. Why are you not hurtling yourself to the southeast?
Well, first of all, they don't do gravy in chip shops, so that's outrageous. But second of all, because it's completely priced out, if you base where I currently am to London, I would never be able to live in London based on the wages there and the cost of living in London, which is massive. Whereas in Preston, that's not the case.
In lots of cases, the cost of spending 6 months earning nothing in order to get a job in London, the evidence would tell us.
Absolutely. I mean, I would love nothing more than to be able to spend 6 months working for absolutely nothing. But unfortunately, that will not pay my rent. That will not pay for my movie subscription either. So unfortunately, that's not something that I can do. But not only that, you create communities where you are. You know, you get to know the area. You know, you want to stay with family. If this pandemic has taught us anything, it's that you want to stay where people who you have formed relationships with are.
But this is the great dichotomy, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you know, this is a government that talks about, I mean, I'm not sure it's ever visited it, but it talks about the North as part of its kind of electoral coalition and talks about levelling up and so on. You know, if you were thinking of an anchor institution in the North, and you know, one of the ones that would come to mind would be UCLan and all the amazing work that it does, both with students and in its supply chains and for the local area and for Preston as a place and so on. But on the other hand, universities are being judged by their graduate recruitment numbers, and that would suggest that the smart thing to do is buy lots and lots of people some season tickets to, you know, that train to Euston and get them down into the southeast. You know, what is that? You know, you'll have been in the meeting, Steph. What is the university to do? Is it supposed to be building up the area, or is it supposed to be, you know, shoveling people into, you know, better paid graduate jobs in other places?
The university, in terms of career prospects for its students, is about equipping students, no matter where they go, to ensure that they are fully ready for wherever they go and are fully supported. And I think that's the big one for them. It's about making sure that they are employable and industry ready.
Wonkfest, our festival of higher education, returns in June. And because of the year we've all just had, we're using it as an opportunity to look ahead. What worked? What didn't? And how can we come back stronger as universities, professionals, and as a sector? And crucially, how can higher education drive the global recovery? It's all about how we build back higher. We'll hear from people who've been at the heart of the government response, like National Statistician Ian Diamond, Vice Chancellors, Students Union Officers, and literally, and I mean literally, everything and everyone in between. It's online only this year, well, because you know why. But we're working hard to keep the best of the Wonkfest, you know, bustling with insights you can take back to your institutions at the end, and Team Wonky will be on hand every step of the way to help guide you through it. It's all happening on 9th and 10th of June. The programme is out now, and you can find out more and book your tickets at wonkfest.co.uk. And as usual, group discounts and Pleasant Planter rates apply. We look forward to seeing you in June to help us build back higher together.
And finally, after a string of allegations in drama schools, Equity has intervened. Steph, what are they saying?
So, the union Equity is saying that we need a change from the top down when it comes to confronting allegations around sexual assault. So, this comes after an investigation by The Telegraph found evidence of bullying alongside sexual assault at top drama schools in the UK. And for drama and art schools leading into the industries they do, there is a dark reputation, which we've seen come to light in recent years through the Me Too movement. But this also comes at a time where universities are truly in the hot seat when it comes to sexual harassment and misconduct within the sector. We've seen it in the documentary The Hunting Ground, which outlined issues in America. But more recently in the UK, we've seen student bodies take to social media to raise awareness of this issue that they feel is not being resolved. The BBC reported that female students are calling for mandatory policy to deal with allegations, alongside a broader sector discussion around mandatory consent training, which is great to hear as long as it's fully implemented and as a biased speaker here is done in consultation with student unions. But there's also the discussion around staff-student relationships. But it seems to be a case of a little less conversation and maybe a little more action needed, please. There's so many questions here. How does the HE sector address these long-standing issues, creating preemptive measures to ensure institutions are safe havens, and then as institutions pride themselves on being industry leading, forging these industry networks for industry ready students, do institutes have that duty of care to ensure that their networks are safe for their alumni and that the alumni feel empowered and informed enough to be vocal when required?
Aaron, you know, one of the things that, you know, struck me about, you know, delving into some of the cases the Telegraph has highlighted is this sense that in quite small, tight-knit, professional, ambitious pockets of education, in this case, in a lot of cases, pockets of higher education, there are greater risks of abuse and harassment than in other parts of the sector. And that's not to say there aren't risks everywhere, but, you know, these types of places, you know, drama schools or medical schools or very small specialist providers, conservatoires, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. You know, this needs a kind of targeted, at the risk of overusing this phrase, risk-based approach, doesn't it?
Very much so. Yes, I mean, the idea that this is just simply, you know, the preserve of drama schools is, of course, not the case. There are lots of examples, lots of disciplines, also lots of levels of study. I mean, at postgraduate level, where a PhD student and their supervisor will, for instance, you know, it's wherever there is wherever there's a power dynamic, or wherever there are small groups, it provides the sort of backdrop for where this sort of inappropriate behaviour can fester. And if I look back over the last 10 years, in some respects, I'm heartened by the fact that this is a great deal more visible. It is being spoken about in a more significant way. But then when I still look at the evidence about what students say, particularly female students, but, there is still data for all sorts of students who face unwarranted and unwelcome kind of attention in this way. And when I look at the reporting data, it is highly variable across the system. And that, to me, doesn't point to the fact that instances are highly variable across the sector. It suggests to me that the ability for students to feel comfortable to report isn't as equal as it needs to be. And I get that there's a long list of things for the regulator, the Office of Students in England, and regulators elsewhere to look at. But if a student feels unsafe, this has surely got to be one of the most important things for the regulators to be considering, but also for institutions and their students' unions to be working on together to try and further eradicate the progress that has been, to be fair, started to be made over the last decade or so.
Steph, in a big university like UCLan, I guess if a student is in a particular academic department or whatever and wanted to make a complaint about something going on in that department, they could go off to the central university and have some confidence that, you know, that will be dealt with in an independent way, because it's, you know, a kind of separate part of the university. But this is much harder in, you know, smaller providers or quite tight-knit departments, isn't it? You know, how do you get to the point where students feel confident to raise something that could be really controversial for their kind of, you know, bit of the sector?
I think that's, again, a very interesting question. I think there's never going to be one set of one framework that will fit all institutions, because like you said, there are varying different sizes of institution, and there will be institutions where everyone knows everyone, and that's difficult. And I think that's where the policy really needs to be strong.
We shouldn't decry that, should we? Because, you know, there are lots of students who feel that their higher education experience is impersonal, who actively disagree on NSS question 21 about feeling part of a community. You know, in some ways, feeling part of a tight-knit community will be amazing for most students most of the time. But that there are some moments where it goes wrong, right?
Absolutely. There are some moments where it goes wrong. You know, that WhatsApp message that happens and then everyone knows what's happening and what's going on and you're the focus of, you know, so many things. And I think what is massively necessary in any sort of situation is that the wraparound support that happens. So it is not that student feeling very alone in making a complaint. What then happens is that well-being is wrapped around that student, that we make it clear to students that there is a strict process, that, you know, they should expect standards of professionalism from the institution, and that they have so many different options, but that needs to be put before them. When a student is faced with this situation, it's all about a loss of control and they want to regain that control. So we need to make sure that the information is there for them to make decisions and to regain that control in a way that they feel is fitting for them. And I think that's really important, regaining that sense of control, but making it really clear to students that we want to hear from them, that they will be listened to, that they will have a really strong policy and process to go off of, and that people can deal with this in a professional manner. I think it's all about making sure that students know the process, understand the process, and can ask questions at any time, and that they have that wraparound support. Regardless of whether you have a massive institution or a very small one, it's all about the support for that student.
Aaron, you are both currently and have previously been involved in a number of, you know, genuinely quite small specialist providers, right? Isn't it the case that on some of this stuff, you know, if we're being honest and we take a kind of macro look at this, there probably isn't the kind of level of expertise and capacity to be able to pull some of this kind of culture change and process stuff off within every small provider? Doesn't there need to be some collaboration amongst small and specialist providers to get where we need to be?
Yeah, it's certainly fair to say that for some of the smallest and most specialist providers, some of whom are most vulnerable to these sorts of instances, they just don't have the capacity and the resource to bring in, you know, teams of counsellors or teams of or sophisticated networks for reporting. And so there does need to be some degree of collaboration. This is not a space in which institutions are competing or ought to be competing. It's been a shame that we've seen sometimes the kind of the dismantling of some of the national networks, whether it's frankly to do with, you know, kind of access, but also in this space. I think it would be really great to see some initiatives where institutions can join up, work together, help one another out, share their expertise for the ultimate benefit of students, both being safer and certainly feeling safer. And I hope that that's something that the sector can work together on.
You know, you definitely work at a university that talks a lot about its partnerships with, you know, industry, you know, both around the recruitment of students and, you know, work that gets done and, you know, the pipeline of graduates, you know, all that kind of stuff about economic regeneration and partnerships with industry and business. But I don't hear a lot of active partnership work going on between universities and industry over changing the culture in their industry. And, you know, most industries surely have got problems with, you know, racism in terms of their, you know, hiring and firing. You know, most industries presumably have got a version of the kind of Me Too story in terms of pockets of their industries protecting abusers. You know, there needs to be partnerships with industry too, don't there? If people are training future nurses and future doctors and future lawyers. And
I'm so glad you asked this, because I truly believe, and I think I speak for a lot of officers here, that the ethics of a university do not stop being afforded to a student once they cross that graduation stage. They should be there. They should make sure that that student, wherever they go into the networks, that they endorse, you know, they bring these networks into the university to speak to their students. They need to make sure that they are safe places for their students. We should never endorse industry partners, or whatever you want to call them, if we don't think that their ethics meet the values that we are teaching our students about respect, about, you know, intersectional support. If they're not meeting them, why are we endorsing them? What is more important, our students or our networks? Do we, you know, turn a blind eye to the misgivings of an industry simply to meet graduate outcomes? I would like to think that that isn't the case.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscription services. So, thanks very much to Aaron, Steph, Mike Ratcliffe, everyone at Team Wonky that helps make the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky.